"Gentlemen," I said, "I think we're on to something good. I only speak aloud to them when I'm excited or drunk, and now I was more than a little of each." "Who are you talking to?" asked Sally from the doorway, making me leap in my seat. It was a rhetorical question. She knew damn well who I was talking to. She lounged against the jamb, her hands thrust deeply into the pockets of her grubby white dustcoat. Dark hair drawn back with a ribbon from the deep, bulging forehead, large green eyes well-spaced beside the pert nose, high cheekbones, wide, sensual, smiling mouth. A big girl, with long, well-muscled legs in the tight-fitting blue jeans. Why do I always like them big? "Good lunch?" she asked, starting the slow, sidling approach across the carpet towards my desk that would put her in position to check what was going on. "She can read documents upside down, as I proved to my cost." "Great," I answered, deliberately covering the photograph with the envelope. "Cold turkey, lobster salad, smoked trout, and a very good duck and truffles in aspic." "You bastard," she whispered softly. She loves good food, and she'd noticed my play with the envelope. I don't allow her to talk to me like that, but then I can't stop her either. 5 feet from me, she sniffed. "And peppermint-flavored malt whiskey. Yummy." I blushed. I can't help it, it's like my stutter. And she burst out laughing and came to perch on the edge of my desk. "Come on, Ben." She eyed the envelope frankly. "I've been bursting since it arrived. I would have steamed it open, but the electric kettle is broken." Dr. Sally Benator has been my assistant for 2 years, which is, coincidentally, the exact period of time that I've been in love with her. I moved aside, making room for her behind the desk, and uncovered the photograph. "All right," I agreed. "Let's see what you make of it." She squeezed in beside me, her upper arm touching my shoulder, a contact that shivered electrically through my whole body. In 2 years, she had become like the children. She didn't seem to notice the hump. She was easy and natural, and I had a timetable worked out. In another 2 years, our relationship would have ripened. I had to go slowly, very slowly, so as not to alarm her. But in that time, I would have accustomed her to the thought of me as a lover and husband. If the last 2 years had been long, I hated to think about the next two. She leaned over the desk, peering into the magnifying lens, and she was still and silent for a long time. A reflected light was thrown up into her face, and when at last she looked up, her expression was rapt. The green eyes sparkled. "Ben," she said. "Oh, Ben, I'm so glad for you." Somehow her easy acceptance and presumption annoyed me. "You're jumping the gun," I snapped. "There could be a dozen natural explanations." "No, no," she shook her head, smiling still. "Don't try and knock it. It's true, Ben, at last. You worked so long and believed so long. Don't be afraid now. Accept it." She slipped out from behind the desk and crossed quickly to the shelf of books under the label K. There are 12 volumes there that bear the author's name, Benjamin Kazin. She selected one and opened it at the flyleaf. "Offer," she read, "by Dr. Benjamin Kazin. A personal investigation of the prehistoric gold-working civilization of Central Africa, with special reference to the city of Zimbabwe and to the legend of the ancients and the lost city of the Kalahari." She came to me smiling. "Have you read it?" she asked. "It's quite entertaining." "There is a chance, Sal, I agree. Just a chance. But where does it lie?" she cut in. "In the mineralized series, as you predicted?" I nodded. "Yes, it's in the gold belt. But it could, it just could, produce so much more than the Langabili and Ruwani." She grinned triumphantly and bent over the lens again. With her finger, she touched the Indian ink arrow in the corner of the photo that gave the northerly bearing. "The whole city—" "If it is a city," I cut in. "The whole city. she repeated with emphasis. "Faces north, into the sun, with the Acropolis behind it. Sun and moon, the two gods, the phallic towers, there are 4, 5, 6, perhaps 7 of them." "Sal, those aren't towers. They're just dark patches on a photograph taken from 36,000 feet. 36,000? Sal's head jerked up. "Well, then it's huge. You could fit Zimbabwe into the main enclosure 6 times."
"Easy, girl, for God's sake."
"And the lower city outside the walls, it stretches for miles. It's enormous, Ben. But I wonder why it's crescent-shaped like that."
She straightened up, and for the first time, the very first wonderful time, she spontaneously threw her arms around my neck and hugged me.
"Oh, I'm so excited. I could die. When do we leave?"
I didn't answer. I hardly heard the question. I just stood there and reveled in the feel of her big warm breasts pressing against me.
"When?"
she asked again, pulling back to look into my face.
"What?"
I asked. "What did you say?" I was both blushing and stuttering, and she laughed.
"When do we leave, Ben? When are we going to find your lost city?"
"Well," and I considered how to phrase it delicately, "Lauren Stevenson and I will go in first. We leave on Tuesday." "Lauren didn't mention an assistant. So I don't think you'll be coming along on the recce."
Sally stepped back and placed her clenched fists on her hips. She looked at me unkindly and asked with deceptive gentleness, "Do you want to bet on that?"
"I like reasonable odds when I do bet." So I told Sally to pack. A week was too long for the job, for she's a professional and travels light. Her personal effects filled a single small valise and a shoulder-strapped carry-all. Her sketchbooks and paints were more bulky, but we pooled our books to avoid duplication. My photographic equipment was another big item, and then the sample bags and boxes, together with my one canvas case, made a formidable pile in the corner of my office. We were ready in 24 hours, and for the next 6 days we killed time by arguing, agonizing, squabbling, and poring over the photograph, which was starting to lose a little of its gloss. When our tensions built up to explosion point, then Sally would lock herself in her own office and try to work on the translation of the rock engraving from Driekoppen, or the painted symbols from the Wittenberg. Rock paintings, engravings, and the translation of the ancient writings are her speciality. I would wander fretfully round the public rooms, trying to find dust on the exhibits, dreaming up some novel way of displaying the treasures that filled our warehouse and upstairs storerooms, counting the names in the visitor's book, playing guides to parties of schoolchildren, doing anything but work. Finally, I'd go upstairs to tap on Sally's door. Sometimes it was, "Come in, Ben," and then again it might be, "I'm busy. What do you want?" And then I would drift through to spend an hour in the African languages section with my dour giant, Timothy Mageba. Timothy started at the Institute as a sweeper and cleaner. That was 12 years ago. It took me 6 months to discover that apart from his own southern Soto, he spoke 16 other dialects. I taught him to speak English fluently in 18 months and to write it in 2 years. He matriculated 2 years later, graduated Bachelor of Arts in another 3. Master's degree in the required further 2 years, and he's working on his doctorate in African languages. He now speaks 19 languages, including English, which is one more than I do, and he's the only man I know, apart from myself, spent 9 months in the desert, living with the little yellow men, who speaks the dialects of both the northern and Kalahari bushmen. For a linguist, he's a peculiarly silent man. When he does speak, it is in basso profundo, which matches well his enormous frame. He stands 6'5" tall, and he's muscled like a professional wrestler. And yet he moves with the grace of a dancer. He fascinates me, and frightens me a little. His head is completely hairless, the rounded pate shaven and oiled to gleam like a midnight black cannonball. The nose, broad and flat, with flaring nostrils, the lips a thick purple-black, and behind them gleam big, strong white teeth. From behind this impassive mask, a chained animal ferocity glowers through the eye-slits, and once in a while flashes like distant summer lightning. There is a satanical presence about him, despite the white shirt and the dark business suit he wears, and though for 12 years I have spent much of my time in his presence, I have never fathomed the dark depth beneath those dark eyes and darker skin. Under my loose surveillance, he runs the African Languages Department of the Institute. 5 younger Africans, 4 men and a girl, work under him. And so far, they've published authoritative dictionaries of the 7 main African languages spoken in Southern Africa. They have also accumulated written and taped material to keep them busy for the next 7 years. On his own initiative, with just a little of my help and encouragement, he has published 2 volumes of African history, which have raised a storm of hysterical abuse from white historians, archaeologists, and reviewers. As a child, Timothy was apprenticed to his grandfather, the witch doctor, and historical custodian of the tribe. As part of his initiation into the mysteries, his grandfather placed Timothy under hypnosis and taped the entire tribal history on his brain. Even now, 30 years later, Timothy is able to throw himself into a trance and establish total recall of this mass of legend, folklore, unwritten history, and magical doctrine. Timothy's grandfather was tried by an unsympathetic white judge and hanged for his part in a series of ritual murders the year before Timothy had completed his training and been entered into the priesthood. However, his legacy to Timothy is a formidable mountain of material, much of it palpably spurious, a great deal of it unpublishable as being either too obscene or too explosive, and the remainder fascinating, puzzling, or downright scary. I have drawn on much of Timothy's unpublished material for my own book, Ophir, particularly those unscientific and popular sections which deal with the legend of the ancients, a race of fair-skinned, golden-haired warriors from across the sea, who mined the gold, enslaved the indigenous tribes, built walled cities, and flourished for hundreds of years before vanishing almost without trace. I am aware that Timothy edits the information he passes on to me. Some of it is too secret. The taboos which surround it too powerful to disclose to other than an initiate of the mysteries. I am sure that much of this withheld information relates to the legend of the ancients. I, however, never abandon my attempts to milk him. On the Monday morning of Lorraine's return from Switzerland, Sally was so overwrought by the possibility that Lorraine would veto her inclusion in the preliminary expedition that her company was unbearable. To escape her, and to kill the last long waiting hours, I went down to Timothy. He works in a tiny room. We're a little pressed for space at the Institute, which is congested with neatly stacked pamphlets, books, folders, and piles of loose paper that reach almost to the ceiling. And yet there is room for my chair. This is a long-legged affair like a barroom stool, for although my legs and arms are regulation size, or better, my trunk is squashed and humped, so that from the seat of an ordinary chair I have trouble seeing over the top of a desk.
Machane, blessed one. Timothy rose with his usual greeting as I entered.
According to Bantu law, those of us with club feet, albino pigmentation, squint eyes, and humped backs are blessed by the spirits and endowed with psychic powers. I derive a sneaky sort of pleasure from this belief, and Timothy's greeting always gives me a lift. I hopped up on my chair and began a desultory conversation which flicked from subject to subject and changed from language to language. Timothy and I are proud of our talents, and I suppose we do show off a little. There is no other man living, and of this I'm convinced, who could follow one of our conversations from beginning to end. "It will be strange," I said at last, in I forget what language, "it will be strange not to have you along on a journey. It will be the first time in 10 years, Timothy." He was immediately silent and wary. He knew I was going to start again on The Lost City. I had shown him the photograph 5 days before, and had been pumping him steadily ever since for some significant comment. I changed into English. "Anyway, you're probably not missing anything. Another groping for shadows. God knows there have been many of those. If only I knew what to look for." I broke off and froze with expectancy. Timothy's eyes had glazed. It's a physical thing. An opaque, bluish film seems to cover the eyeballs. His head sinks down on the thick, corded column of the neck. His lips twitch, and the goose flesh runs up my arms, and the hair on the back of my neck fans erect. I waited. As often as I'd seen it, I could never shake off the supernatural thrill of watching Timothy going into trance. Sometimes it is involuntary. A word or a thought will trigger it, and the reflex is almost instantaneous. And then again, it can be a deliberate act of auto-hypnosis. But this involves preparation and ritual. This time, it was spontaneous. And I waited eagerly, knowing that if the material was taboo, it would be but a few seconds only before Timothy broke the spell with a deliberate effort of will. "Evil," and he spoke in the quavering, high-pitched voice of an old man, the voice of his grandfather. A little spittle wet the thick purple lips. "An evil to be cleaned from the earth and from the minds of men forever." His head jerked, the conscious mind intervening. His lips worked loosely. The brief internal struggle, and suddenly his eyes cleared. He looked at me and saw me.
"I'm sorry," he murmured in English, turning his eyes away now, embarrassed by the involuntary display and the need to exclude me. "Would you like some coffee, Doctor? They've repaired the kettle at last."
I sighed. Timothy had switched off. There'd be no more communication that day. He was closed up and defensive. To use his own expression, he had turned nigger on me. "No thanks, Timothy." I looked at my watch and slept off the stool. "Still some last-minute things to do."
"Go in peace, Mahani, and the spirits guide your feet."
We shook hands. "Stay in peace, Timothy. And if the spirits are kind, I will send for you."